Hello, and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate, one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. You ever had a male client in the context of a systemic individual, couple, or even family therapy that has had extreme difficulty in describing how they feel or expressing any type of genuine emotion? If so, this following podcast is sure to enlighten. Alexithymia, that's derived from the Greek, meaning no emotion for words. This psychological construct is used to describe people who struggle with feeling and expressing emotions. It represents a reduced ability or sometimes complete inability to be connected with your internal emotive signals that your body sends you. If your client has alexithymia, they do not only have trouble knowing how they feel, they also struggle to discern how others feel, including their partner or family members. This can make them socially anxious, and they cannot read verbal cues. They may come across as socially awkward, lacking in humor, and it can often put relationships in danger areas because generally, women need to talk about emotions to feel a connection, and these alexithymic men often just can't go there. Our podcast today introduces concepts related to what our guest has deemed normative male alexithymia. And we start that by talking about the origins of Dr. Ron Levant's journey and his long-term study of men's emotional experience and expression. And that was associated with his time in the Fatherhood Project at Boston University in the 1980s. And Dr. Levant's signature contribution has been in establishing the empirical foundation for normal male alexithymia. In addition, he's developed a treatment called alexithymia reduction treatment, or more clearly, ART. ART is a brief psychoeducational intervention designed to remediate this normative male alexithymia in order to prepare men to engage more fully in psychotherapy. ART can be an adjunctive treatment that can be administered prior to or concurrently with traditional individual or couple therapy. Ron Levant earned his doctorate in clinical psychology and public practice from Harvard. He was on the faculty of Boston University, where he directed the nationally prominent Fatherhood Project, as I mentioned. He's been part of the Harvard Medical School, at the Cambridge Hospital, and the Center for Psychological Studies. And he served as the dean at Nova Southeastern University. Currently, he is professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Akron, where he was also the dean of the Bucktel College of Arts and Sciences. Ron was the 2005 president of the American Psychological Association, and he served as the editor of Psychology of Men and Masculinity, a journal from 2007 to 2015. I'm very honored to have a pioneer in men's psychology and masculinity join us on the podcast today. We will be back after our interview with Dr. Ron Levant. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Ron Levant, a pioneer in the psychology of men and masculinity. And today we are going to talk specifically about emotionally inexpressive men, or what has been deemed normative male alexithymia. But Ron, the first question is always, we'd like to know about our expert your therapeutic origin story, so to speak, and specifically how you got interested in both researching and clinically working with emotionally inexpressive men.
Thanks, Eli. I went to graduate school a long time ago, and before family therapy was even taught in graduate school. This was at Harvard in a crazy cockamamie program called Clinical Psychology and Public Practice. Several of us students got together and put together a reading list. This was like 1972, and there weren't many resources available. When I did my internship at the Cambridge Child Guidance Clinic, the interns and other lower-level staff members revolted and demanded some family therapy training. So we got somebody coming up from the Eastern Pennsylvania Psychiatric Institute to offer trainings. But then after I graduated, I largely gravitated towards the Bowenian model and would travel from Boston to New Rochelle for weekend trainings with Tom Fogarty and Phil Guerin. And by the way, in an interesting little karmic twist, Tom Fogarty's granddaughter was one of my doctoral students at Akron. And after I completed my doctoral training, I started my first tenure track job at Boston University in the counseling department, and it offered master's and doctoral level training. It was a graduate department. And a fortuitous set of circumstances enabled me to open up a project to the community for fathers. This was in the early 80s, when men were just starting to be noticed as caregivers. You could see fathers in Harvard Square carrying infants in snuggly packs or pushing strollers. And the father's role was just starting to change. And I, at the time, also in my personal life, I was a divorced semi-custodial father in that my daughter lived with me during the summers, and I visited her on the weekends. Her mother and she lived in New York City. Got an opportunity to set up this project. And basically the idea was to help men who wanted to become more hands-on parents learn the skills of parenting, because men really did not get much preparation as compared to women, as you probably know. As a matter of fact, I went up with one of my students. We did a lit review to see if the reviews of the literature on parent education indicated whether the groups they were reviewing even included fathers. And we concluded that they did not, that parent education was synonymous with mother education. And so the confluence of events, my personal interest in fathering, societal changes, and the clear absence of any guidance for men who would essentially be hands-on dads, came together, and I started this thing called the Boston University Fatherhood Project. Now, the university wanted a community-facing program at the time, and I stepped up, and they lavished resources on me, and I had a grant, I had a great conference room, and I spent a lot of the grant money on video equipment, because back in the early 80s, video equipment was very cool, and I bought more video equipment than any sane person would ever want.
Sure. The birth of VHS and recording and observing.
And so I had three setups with decks, special effects generators. I had three places in the room where a microphone would come out of the ceiling and a tripod with a camera was set up so different people could work at the same time. And it was also a great prop because at that time, men were not very keen on counseling programs. And so, but when they came into the room, kind of our bona fides were established. You know, they looked at us and said, these guys must really have it going on. Look at all this incredible equipment. And we told them, yeah, we're going to help you become a better dad in the same way you might have learned a sport like golf or tennis. We're going to do it. We're going to videotape it. We're going to watch the recording and then figure out how to do it better. That's how we began. Typically, these were held once a week in the evening for a couple of hours, and 8 to 12 men It ran for a number of years, and I ran them with a grad student who later did his dissertation on this topic, Greg Doyle. But anyway, one particular evening, one of the fathers seemed out of sorts to me just by his nonverbal behavior. So I approached him. I said, "You seem not like yourself. Is there something the matter?" And he said, "Yeah, my son stood me up for my father-son hockey game." And I said, and this was a divorced father, so obviously connection with his son through this sport.
Especially hockey is huge in Boston, too. That's like a ritual between fathers and sons, for sure.
Yeah, go Bruins, right? Anyway, knowing anything about men and emotions at that time, I asked him, "How did that make you feel?" And he looked at me and he said, "He shouldn't have done it," with his face in an angry expression and pointing his finger. And I said, "Yeah, I agree, but how did you feel?" And he looked at me blankly. So I said, "Why don't we role play this? You be you. Don, why don't you play his ex-wife as she delivered the news to him that his son had forgot about the date? And then we'll videotape it." So we do that. And then we replay the video, and I'm sitting right next to, this guy's name was Tim. I'm sitting right next to Tim, and I'm looking at the video with him, and it's a short video. And I'm saying, "Look at yourself in the monitor, Tim. What were you feeling?" So Tim is rubbing his chin, hunching his shoulders. He says, "I guess I must have felt disappointed." I thought to myself, "I guess I must have felt disappointed with all this coaching. How can that be?" And I imagined in my mind how a mother might react if her daughter had stood her up for a shopping date. At first, this is going out of my head. At first, I was surprised. Then I was hurt that she acted with so little regard for my feelings. Then I was worried that maybe she was mad at me and this is her way of showing it. She has done that. And finally, I was disappointed and annoyed. I built my whole day around this and now it was ruined. So in my head, I'm going, "I guess I must have felt disappointed versus surprised, hurt, worried, disappointed, annoyed. What's going on here?" I went back to my colleagues. It turned out we had a faculty meeting the next day. And so I asked if I could have a few minutes to ask a question. And I said, I presented the situation, and my colleagues were no help at all. They said, "Ron, women are just more emotional by nature." I didn't buy that. I didn't think that something as fundamental as emotional awareness and expressivity could be differentiated on the basis of sex. I was aware that there was at that point, two-volume series on the psychology of sex differences. And basically, it cataloged a large number of sex differences, but they were all very small. And so I just didn't buy this. So when I did my internship, I had an opportunity to concentrate in child clinical, which has connected me to family. And I had to take more developmental psych courses than my classmates. So I was aware there was a literature. So I went back to that research literature. And by the way, these were studies that you couldn't do today. They set up videotapes in people's homes and videotaped them around the clock and then paid people to transcribe the videotapes and code them. Can you imagine how much money it would cost to do something like that? And so here's what I found, that boys are more emotionally expressive than girls as neonates. But neonates don't do much. They cry and they sleep, basically. But that same difference in a later study was of six-month-olds, where six-month-old babies do a lot more than neonates, held up that boys were more emotionally expressive through gestures at the mother and coo and giggling and things of this nature. And another later study showed that it held up at 1 year of age. So I'm thinking, girls are more emotional than boys? What? That doesn't seem what the research is saying. But then at 2 years of age, girls started to overtake boys in terms of their verbal expressivity of emotions. That is, they use more emotion words. "I'm afraid. I feel sad. I feel lonely." I love you, things of that nature. But then the most remarkable change occurred between 4 and 6, where boys lost their facial expressivity. And this was an ingenious study in which mothers were brought into the laboratory with one of their children between the ages of 4 and 6, a boy or a girl. And the child was in one room with the experimenter, and the mother was in another room with a video monitor. And the child was shown emotionally stimulating slides, and the mother had to guess what slide was shown to her son. That is, what emotion was targeted by the slide. So at 4 years of age, mothers were equally accurate with sons and daughters, no differences. But as the children age, moms grew less accurate with their boys, until by the age of 6, there were significant differences. So what's happening to boys between 4 and 6? They're in preschool and elementary school, and their conformity to the masculine norm to restrict the expression of emotions was being policed by their peers. I was aware of kind of the work that Joe Pleck had done on the gender role strain paradigm, and that Bob Brannon had done on the what he called the Brannon masculinity scale. So I was aware of masculine norms. And I was aware that one of the masculine norms that these groundbreaking pioneers were identifying was that men are not emotional. This fit the stereotype that my colleagues told me about, formulated actually not at the time of the Fatherhood Project, but later when I went to, I left BU in 88 and went to Rutgers. And at that time, I was working with my doctoral students on creating the male role norms inventory, which became my most well-known instrument. It's gone through 5 different versions since then. So I theorized that boys who were reared as boys to conform to the masculine norm of restricting the expression of emotions grew up to be men who had an elevated risk for alexithymia. Now, let me define that term, because your audience may not have heard that term. Alexithymia simply means without words for emotions. It's a clinical construct that grew up in the 70s and 80s in the psychosomatic disorders field, and since then has migrated to quite a number of other fields. And in fact, today there's an interdisciplinary international association of alexithymia researchers, actually, about almost 100 people. So I theorize that, and this would obviously not be all men, but some men who were more strongly socialized to not express their emotions had this elevated risk. So that was in probably 89, 90. And over the decades, I tried to establish the empirical foundation for what I call the normative male alexithymia hypothesis by, first of all, doing a literature review, but then secondly, doing a meta-analysis. And maybe your audience doesn't know what that is, but a meta-analysis is a way of statistically aggregating the findings from a large number of studies that use the same variables. So I did a meta-analysis of all the studies that assessed alexithymia in men and women, and found that indeed men had higher scores than women. Anyway, this is how it arose.
Yeah, that is a great overview. You also do such a great job of distilling the research down into digestible components, and that's what therapists need to do that aren't going to go on to create original research like you do in order to psychoeducate their clients. So what do you think is the most important psychoeducation that every practicing clinician should know if they're going to work with this population of men?
They should know that it's eminently treatable.
So when a man comes in, whether it's an individual therapy or couples therapy, and just says, I'm not emotional, I'm not wired that way, I didn't grow up that way, I can't do this.
I would probably empathize. I would start off by saying that you feel it's very important for you, for people to know that you're not an emotional guy. You were sent here by your wife. She's worried that something's wrong because you don't seem to express emotions at times that she thinks other people might. So I might come back with something like that. So obviously, if you're going to treat a man's alexithymia, you're going to have to give him a rationale for why you're doing that. And if he thinks, no, you're not messing with my masculinity, then you've got to start where he is and empathize with how he feels about it and hopefully get to a point where he's willing to listen to you. But most of the clients, by the way, I hopped around a lot. I left Rutgers and went back to Boston. I actually never moved from Boston. I commuted to Rutgers for 2 years. I set up my practice. I had a full-time practice and a part-time appointment at Harvard Medical School at the Cambridge Hospital. And I set up my practice to focus on treating men because I was really curious about what I had been seeing. I put an ad in the Yellow Pages, which was a big directory, counseling for men. And I told my colleagues at Cambridge Hospital, send me the guys that your women clients complain about. Trickled in, but eventually built up a practice of many men who had difficulty in relationships, but a number of whom were alexithymic. And I experimented with techniques to help them overcome it. And I subsequently manualized this treatment. It's called alexithymia reduction treatment. It's
what we're going to talk about today. Art.
Art, right. That's my little, I always embed a little joke in my research, but there's art and science in psychotherapy.
Yeah, true.
When you're educating these men, like you said, first you empathize with them and you tell them it is something they can learn to be more emotional, even if they don't necessarily have a model or a blueprint for that. What other important parts of psychoeducation would you tell them to set the stage for art?
Since most of my clients were men, although I did see some couples, heterosexual couples, where there was a woman, I often used myself. I said, I grew up very much like you. Boys don't cry. I understand that. I get that. But we're living in a different era now where, well, if you're married, women want more communication from us. They want to know more about how we're feeling. They want to feel closer to us. So I try to sell it that way. Along those lines, if the guy has kids, I'll say, wouldn't it be nice if you could open up your heart to your family? So I'll use things that I think are appealing to a lot of men to try to get them on board with the idea. If a guy isn't on board, obviously we won't do it. But I think of all the clients I had, I can only remember one who refused, and he didn't stay in therapy long, and he was a hard drug user, so I didn't expect to succeed very much. I have not had much success with hard drug users. People who inject intravenously, I just have not had much success with them. But in any event, so I try to get them on board. I do an assessment. Back then, it was a set of questions. It was like an interview. And I developed a scale called the Normative Male Alexithymia Scale that I subsequently revised as the Normative Male Alexithymia Scale brief form. And it's only a half a dozen questions, and you can essentially score it in the session at my website, drronaldlevant.com. People can request my scales. I give them away. I just want to know what you're using them for. And if it's for research, I like to see the final results, so in case I do a meta-analysis on them. So I do an assessment, and if the man meets criteria, then I say, there's a treatment that I've developed that I think could help you be better aware of what you're feeling. And some men will right away say, well, I don't want to be overwhelmed by emotions. And I'll say, I agree. I don't think that would be a good thing for anybody.
Just anecdotally, Ron, they're not going to use a technical term like alexithymia, but how many of them come in with their presenting problem as saying, I have a hard time expressing my emotions versus some other presenting issue that you pick up on like you did from that guy, Tim, in the group all those years ago?
I would say the vast majority are ones who are not aware that they have a problem, or they've been told it's a problem, but they're not so sure about it. They've come in, like a lot of the men in my practice were sent, and maybe it's because of the way I recruited them, but they were sent by their wives or in some cases by their supervisors because they had various kinds of interpersonal problems at work. It's not like a man wakes up one day and says, you know what? I've got normative male alexithymia.
No one's ever said that, but that's where getting them on board or taking what they come up with and tying it into a rationale of why learning to express themselves better would help them for whatever they are complaining about, a significant other or a work stressor. That seems the key. So I didn't mean to cut you off. So you first assess them using your scale, and if they meet the criteria, then let's talk about what the treatment looks like, kind of basic structure and key interventions associated with ART.
Okay, there are three key interventions, and I can describe each one in detail. One is developing a vocabulary for emotion words. The second is learning to read emotions in other people. And the third is deciphering your own emotions. Shall I take them one by one?
Great, go ahead.
All right. I found, even before I was deep into this in my practice, I also led men's groups that were growth groups as opposed to therapy groups. This was during the 90s. In the 90s, if you may or may not remember, was the big decade of the crisis of masculinity, and you had Robert Bly and the mythopoetic movement. That was what was going on. So I would do these groups sometimes just as a way of introducing my practice. And one of the exercises, I asked men to name emotions, and I'd write them down on a flip chart. And this was way before whiteboards or any of that kind of high-tech stuff. This was just low-tech paper and a Marxalot. And with 8 to 9 guys, I might get 30 words. And I'd say, give me some words that describe emotions. And I'd write them down. So of those 30 words, about 20 would be expressions of anger, pissed off, furious, irritated, annoyed. Okay. And then about 8 or 9 were words that weren't even emotions at all, but rather signs of stress, like burdened or zapped or depleted. And then 1 or 2 words were genuine emotion words, like joy or fear. And I came to, from that experience, and fast forward to what we were talking about a moment ago, I figured that many men probably don't have a good vocabulary for emotion words. So I start there, and I ask them to think of as many words that describe an emotion as they can, and write it down and bring it in next week, okay? And of course, I sneakily rely on men's competition. And I'll say, the guy that I saw just before you came in with 30 words, and I could be sure this guy's going to come in with 31. So that takes maybe, for most guys, a week, sometimes a couple weeks. In my book, I have a book out, just came out this summer, called The Assessment and Treatment of Emotionally Inexpressive Men, courtesy of a colleague. I have a whole long list of emotion words that, in my book, you can copy pages and give it to clients. There's homework assignments and different things like that. So you can give them this list.
This is a more updated version working. You have this background working with children. A play therapist uses a feeling card, almost like a flashcard, to teach emotions to a young child. This is a more adult version for men.
Yeah, specifically for men who are likely to be alexithymic. Because as I said, it's not all men, and there are many men who have a good vocabulary for emotion words and are self-aware and communicate how they're feeling when appropriate and the likes. It's not all men. Some people ask how many. We haven't done a prevalence study in America, but there was one done in Finland, and 17% of men met criteria for alexithymia. And I should say, there is a way to determine using a scale called the Toronto Alexithymia Scale 20, the TAS 20, that the scale developers actually clinically validated cutoffs on it. So you can trust those cutoffs and tell if a person meets criteria. But anyway, that's how that prevalence study that I mentioned was conducted. But anyway, so once they develop a bit of emotion vocabulary, and I encourage them to keep working on it, I asked them to turn their attention to how other people express emotions. And I'll teach them about facial expressions, tone of voice, paralinguistic phenomena like sighs, cries, gasps, body language. And I'll ask them during the course of the week as they're talking to somebody, or even as they're watching the television, to ask themselves the question as they listen to a speaker, what are they feeling while they're saying this? And to try and write it down, what they think it might be based on their observations of these nonverbal signs of emotion. And this takes a little longer. It's a little harder. Might take a couple weeks for some men. Some men get it right away. There's a distribution of abilities among men. And so once they've got that, the third step is to identify emotions in themselves. Now, Eli, I have had men in my practice who didn't actually feel emotions as emotions. They were more severely alexithymic. What they were aware of feeling was a bodily sensation. They didn't feel like fear or sadness or joy or any of that, but they might feel a tight band across their forehead or butterflies in their stomach or some bodily sensation that probably represents the physiological arousal that precedes the experience of an emotion, but they're more alexithymic. They just don't even feel it as an emotion.
So how would you work with a guy like that?
The same way I work with a guy who can feel his emotions, and I'll tell you exactly how. I ask either type of man that when they're either feeling an emotion or they're feeling a bodily sensation that they think might be connected to an emotion, to write it down. I'll ask them to keep some 3x5 index cards in their shirt pocket or someplace where they can easily get them. And once you're feeling something, whatever it is, write it down, describe it. And then analyze the social situation. Who is doing what to whom and how does that affect you? And then finally, after you've got that, go through your vocabulary list that you've been keeping all these weeks and pick out the word or words that might describe how you're feeling. Now, you might think this is emotional kindergarten. And I would say, yes, it is, because for many of these men, their ability to identify and describe their emotions was probably interrupted when they were very young. So I'll give an example about this emotional response log. Okay. So my client is at his office. He's feeling something. He's feeling an emotion. He doesn't know what it is. Who is doing what to whom? I had expected feedback on my progress report from my supervisor, and it's about a half hour after I expected it. Okay, go through the word or words. Go through your vocabulary list. Apprehensive. You can see how this works, right? Is that clear?
Okay.
So that's, and then obviously practice. We have to continue this. Now, these interventions take up 10 minutes of a session. So obviously they can fit with any model of therapy. As I said, I practice Bowenian family therapy. So they fit nicely within what I did with my client.
Since you said that, and every listener or most listeners to our show will be intricately familiar with Murray Bowen and his premises, including differentiation, how do you think differentiation is correlated with alexithymia?
Well, people who are less differentiated generally tend to confuse their thoughts with their feelings or merge them, as Bowen has described. So an exercise like this would fit nicely and has fit nicely with Bowen family therapy, because it gives them some tools to begin to identify what they're feeling. They probably know what they're thinking, but when their thoughts and feelings are merged in that way, it's very difficult to sort it out.
I was going to say, it's interesting in your three-prong approach, how much we talk about nature and nurture and what a young man was exposed to, not only at school from his peers, but also in his family of origin. How much in your discussion and helping these gentlemen identify their feelings, how much do you talk about their blueprint as far as how they grew up in their family with their own fathers?
Only if they take me there. In other words, I don't point in that direction. We can talk a little bit about a case, actually, where it did go there.
Yeah, go ahead.
So this is a guy who was sent by his wife. They had been married for 15 years, and just at this point in life, were starting a family. She was pregnant, and she was concerned, and the reason why they waited so long is because this was a guy in a career that required frequent relocations and moves and things of that nature, and that they never really felt like they were settled enough to start a family. When they finally got to Boston, I guess he had some job security or didn't feel like he was going to be moved around for a while. So they did. They started a family. She was pregnant. She suggested that he see a psychologist, and I don't remember how he found me. I actually don't. I should try to see if I have any notes on that. But she suggested he see a psychologist. He wound up in my office because she was concerned that she was pregnant and he didn't seem to feel anything about it at all. And anybody who's been a parent for longer than 15 minutes knows that becoming a parent is both exhilarating and terrifying and everything in between for the first time, obviously, for some folks, even subsequent times. So she was concerned. So that was how he came into the picture. The other thing she mentioned is she was worried that he was like his father in that way. His father was not emotionally expressive. And so she took a stand that he really should see a psychologist, and he wound up in my office. So he was an interesting guy in terms of what happens to your awareness of your family of origin once you overcome alexithymia. Because in the initial session, when he talked about his father, it was very superficial. His father was a World War II vet, like my father was. So we were about the same general age range. And his father was a tail gunner, which was those guys who sit in, as he described it, in the butt end of a bomber with a machine gun, shooting at enemy aircraft as the enemy aircraft tries to shoot the bomber down. And so his dad always talked about World War II, and he had all this memorabilia, and he had his World War II buddies, and he talked about being 1 second from death and how exciting that was. That's one thing that he remembered about his dad. But his dad was also a publisher. He was the publisher of the community newspaper. So my client, when he got into high school, became the editor of the school paper. Obviously, he's looking for some connection with his father. By the way, the family constellation was mother, father, and a sister, a younger sister. And my client, as a boy, wanting to get close to his dad, who seemed very aloof and uninterested in him, became the editor of the school newspaper. He wanted to find some way to connect with his dad, but his dad couldn't be bothered. As he put it initially, my dad was not the kind of happy-go-lucky, take-you-out-to-the-ballgame kind of dad. I remember that expression very clearly, as if he had said it just the other day. But it was clear that there was something that he wasn't getting at. To have no feelings about becoming a father suggests to me that he had a lot of unresolved issues with his own father. And I encouraged him. His family lived in, I believe it was in Minnesota, and he now lived in Boston. And he went home. His father had passed away, but he went home to visit his mother periodically. So I suggested on one of those visits to ask some questions and try to gather some information about what the relationship was like, and so on and so forth. And he was coming up empty until we did the art. And it was in one session where he got very angry. He was describing his father had a heart attack, and my client was in the army at that time, but he could have gotten leave to come visit, and he didn't. And when describing that he didn't, and his reaction at the time, giving the index finger and with both hands, said, "Fuck you. I don't have to go see you. In our family, we don't connect with each other." So it was clear that he was very, despite the first 6 weeks or so of very placid, kind of discussions with his father that there was considerable anger at his father for the lack of connection. Oh, and by the way, his father subsequently died from a second heart attack. He didn't visit his father after the first heart attack. And as these things tend to go, as you probably are aware, the father had a second one within a short period of time and died. And he never got to see his father at the end. So I suggested that he probably had a lot of questions he'd love to ask his dad. Why don't you write those questions down on these 3x5 cards you've been using for your emotional response log and bring them in and we talk about them? And so he did. And it was like, what did you really think about me? And did you really love me and his sister as well? Did you worry about me? Were you proud of me? Things along these lines.
Now, let me ask you this. So you had done really good work with this guy and you addressed his historical and current, at the time of his death, ambivalence or lack of emotional connection with his father. Many men can talk about the emotions, but they don't effectively show them or experience them in the moment. So I would imagine as you were setting the scene for that, could be a very emotional moment. There could be tears. There could be a quivering or a shake in the voice. What is your take on actually not only this labeling, but actually experientially feeling the feeling, so to speak?
He had gone through ART. This is a very dutiful client. He continued the exercises even after I stopped giving him homework. So yes, indeed, he was able to tell me that he was very angry and about this void in his relationship with his dad. And then I suggested a technique, I think I might have gotten from Monica McGoldrick, of suggesting the next time he visits home, to go to the gravesite and take his set of questions with him. And read the questions as he's looking at the gravesite, is I wanted to get him beyond anger to the sadness, to the grief.
That's a powerful moment, a powerful visual, also very private between him and his deceased father, where he can practice what you've taught him to do.
He loved his wife, and he trusted her, and he, as a result of that, really went wholeheartedly into what I offered. So I think that his motivation, obviously, was his wife and her concern for him. And also the fact that, how much he cognized the fact that he was going to become a father, but that had to figure in there somehow. He did do this. He went to the gravesite with his cards, and he didn't bring his mother, but he brought a family friend who worked with his father. His father, as I said, published a newspaper, and this guy worked in the press. And so he brought this guy, because this guy was the closest thing, aside from his mother, but the closest person to his father that he knew. And he broke down for sobbing at the gravesite. And this guy's name was Henry. Henry had his arm around him and comforted him, and he just had a really extended grief session right there at the gravesite. And we had a few sessions after that. I think he was largely treated at that point. We talked about it. He used to talk about there being a family curse of uncaring fathers that his father had, and he was destined to be that way. And so I asked him about the curse, and he just said, no, the curse is all gone. I don't feel that anymore. And then we terminated, and then his son was born a couple of months after we terminated, and he sent me a postcard. I should say that another thing about this guy was he was of Scottish ancestry, and that was one of the things that concerned him. Once he became aware of his emotions about his child, he began worrying about certain illnesses that are genetic illnesses that are more prevalent in Scottish families, like Tay-Sachs and things of that nature. I encouraged him to go to the OBGYN visit with his wife and ask about that, and he did. But anyway, after we terminated, he wrote a postcard, and he said, the boy was born, not a particularly difficult delivery, 8 pounds, 6 ounces, or some such thing, the statistics. And at the end, he says, and he looks Scottish. That, to me, suggested the multi-generational kind of connection between his father, himself, and his son had been preserved.
Any last words of wisdom for our listeners out there that are interested in learning more about working with emotionally inexpressive men?
Yeah, first of all, there's my book that brings together my scales, my treatment manuals for individual and group therapy, a clinical trial that I ran, and a couple of case studies. One, this case study that we just talked about, and another one where I did this approach in a couples therapy format.
That's wonderful. I can't thank you enough, Ron Levant. Wealth of knowledge, a great storyteller and a true practitioner scientist. You can find out everything you need to about Ron at drronaldlevant.com. Spell that out, drronaldlevant.com. Did you know that AMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AMFT, you can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcast and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy, like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including I have two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors, you want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy, from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.